the more comfort and safety you insist on, the more, the less of your time will be available, and ultimately the less free you really will be able to be. If you have to take a shower every day, you will never be able to spend the night in the woods, right? I mean, that's just a loss, a voluntary loss of freedom. If you refuse to be hot or cold or hungry or tired or what have you, you really have to live your life in the sort of confines of a modern American lifestyle that, you know, is very free in some ways, but also creates a kind of dependency in almost everyone that is the opposite of freedom. So one of the things we were experimenting with on our trek was, if we're willing to be exhausted, we were moving 10, 20 miles a day, we were carrying 60 or 70 pounds, you know, we walked through heat waves, we walked through blizzards, you know, what have you, like, if we were willing to suffer, could we, would we be more free? And it's sort of in an immediate sort of animal level, absolutely.
Welcome to the Spartan Up podcast with Joe DeSena, founder and CEO of Spartan Race.
We are talking about overcoming obstacles. The same way we teach people to get over obstacles on the course, we will teach you here on the Spartan Up podcast to get over obstacles in your mind.
Sebastian Junger, author of The Perfect Storm, War and Tribe, and director of the film Restrepo, has a new book, Freedom. That's what he and Joe DeSena talk about on the show today.
This episode of Spartan Up is brought to you by Brightside. Dealing with anxiety or depression can be paralyzing, but you should know you are not broken and you're not alone. And when you want help, Brightside is there for you. Take a free mental health assessment and get up to $100 credit on your first month of treatment at brightside.com/Spartan. That's brightside.com/Spartan.
I am Joe DeSena, CEO and founder of Spartan. We do the Spartan Up podcast in an attempt to rip you off the couch and get you not reading books, but get you running through the mountains. However, we got Sebastian Junger, who wrote The Perfect Storm. Our Perfect Storm was the movie? What was the movie?
The Perfect Storm.
And this great new book that I just read 2 days ago, Freedom. I don't know how it ended up in my office, but I saw somebody had it, and I was getting on a flight, and I said, you know what? I'm going to read that book. And I, no bullshit, I'm not telling the audience this because we're talking to each other, but I picked it up at the beginning of the flight. I flew to Denver. I put it down at the end of the flight because I was done with it, and I've recommended it to a half a dozen people already. Great book.
Thank you.
It depicts you and some friends, I assume they were friends, walking on train tracks for quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, so the book has sort of two components. One is this trek that I did with two or three other guys. We'd all been in a lot of combat, and that's all I say about it. It's not, this isn't a book about veterans issues or anything like that. It's really a book about America and about what freedom has meant for the past, say, 10,000 years in the human experience. And so we walked along the railroad lines, which are these swaths of no man's land that crisscross America, from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia. And then we decided to turn west, and we headed for Pittsburgh. We were sleeping under bridges and in abandoned buildings and cooking over fires and drinking out of creeks and avoiding the police. At one point, they had a helicopter looking for us. It's technically illegal to be on railroad lines. And we, as I say in the book, you know, for 400 miles, we were most nights the only people who knew where we were. And that's at least one interesting definition of freedom. And so I talk about this high-speed vagrancy is what we call it. I talk about this high-speed vagrancy, you know, moving 10, 20 miles a day with pretty heavy packs, carrying everything we need. And then I go into a discussion about how sort of underdog groups are able to maintain their autonomy in the face of a greater power, which is sort of a working definition of the word freedom.
Vietnam came to mind when you dove into some of those topics, right, about the underdogs and maybe smaller armies or smaller, I can't call them enemies, right, smaller sides of a battle actually do better.
Well, it's interesting. Like humans, just for starters, we're the only mammal where a smaller individual can defeat a larger individual in combat. the biggest chimpanzee, the biggest gorilla, the biggest elk, the biggest mouse, whatever, invariably dominates these conflicts. And in fact, there's a whole dominance hierarchy that actually avoids conflicts because the largest male typically can face down anyone else. And that's how disputes are decided. With humans, that's not true. And it's really for a really interesting reason. Of course, size and strength are huge advantages. And if there's a fight happening in a shower stall, the big guy is going to win, right? That's just how it works. But as soon as you physically open up the arena a little bit, being large and strong is an advantage, but it also uses up a lot more oxygen, a lot more metabolic resources. And so if the big guy doesn't win fairly quickly, there's a chance that he never will, because the smaller entity can basically go for longer than the larger one can. And so what we see in Afghanistan, and I just have to say at the outset, I loathe the Taliban. I loathe them because they're antithetical to human rights and to human dignity, in my opinion. But they were able to outfight, outlast, avoid defeat, facing the greatest military power ever. For 20 years, we left basically on their terms. They didn't have an air force. They didn't have artillery. They didn't have tanks. A lot of them didn't even have boots, right? And they were able to avoid being defeated by us until we just got tired and left. And so this sort of like mismatch of a larger power that burns through resources at an unsustainable rate, it scales up very neatly from the individual to a fighting group.
And so it's funny, a friend of mine reads like one book a day for the last 30 years. So I immediately sent them Freedom. And I said, I'd love for you to read it and I want to talk about it. And so I did even better than that. I got the author on the phone here. But are you saying then that, look, just because you're an underdog, actually you could experience freedom because there are some huge advantages you have?
Yeah, I mean, there's huge advantages and disadvantages. So it's a coin toss. But my point is that for the rest of the animal species, it's not a coin toss. The larger coalition or the larger individual will win. And so one of the things I looked at in Freedom was, how does the underdog group maintain its autonomy? And the book is divided into three sections: run, fight, and think. The first thing that groups do is use their mobility. And I looked at the Apache in the American Southwest and the way they were able to maintain their freedom compared to the Pueblo societies that were materially much richer, right? They were agriculturalists. They lived in towns. They had irrigation, very affluent societies. And they got rolled by the Spanish immediately in the late 1500s. The Apache remained autonomous for another 300 years, almost to within my grandmother's lifetime. And they did that because they were so mobile. The warriors were expected to be able to run 70 miles a day, day after day, while fighting the U.S. cavalry. They could outrun cavalry in tough terrain.
You know, I grew up in Queens, New York, if you ever saw the movie Goodfellas. And not too far from there, when my mother got into yoga and meditation and became a vegan back in the 70s, she bumped into a guru from India who started a race called the Transcendence Run. And it's a 3,100-mile foot race around a one-mile loop. And that experience, seeing that race, knowing about it, and then all the races we put on around the world, when I read that in the book about the Apache, I thought, you know, when I've been in the best shape of my life, where I've seen friends, athletes that are in the best shape of their life, from a running point of view, that's not inconceivable at all.
Right. Right. Yeah. We're an extraordinary species. I mean, the 1,000-mile world record is 10 days, right? So someone ran basically 100 miles a day for 10 days. And, you know, there are very few species. There are no species really that have the breadth of, maybe wolves, that have the breadth of sort of like sprinting ability. I mean, the 400-meter world record is you know, something like 20 miles an hour. Average, from that to a 1,000-mile record in 10 days, like that's an extraordinary range for one species to have. And we sweat, right? We can run in heat. I mean, I had a wonderful dog named Daisy that was with us on this high speed vagrancy trek that we undertook some years ago. And she's since passed away, but she was an incredible runner, right? And she was a mixed breed, about 50 pounds. And one day I was out on a bike and we went, on a rolling, measured 3 mile course. And she happily did it in 9 minutes, right? I mean, three minute miles over rolling terrain. And she stopped to chase a squirrel in the middle of it, right? But on a hot day, I could outrun her. I mean, anything over 80 degrees, and I had to wait for her. And that's, you know, another advantage of that the humans have over other animals.
And the ability to be free, I guess, is what you're saying, right? We've got the tools, the tool set.
Yeah, we don't live in a dominance hierarchy. We don't live in a society that is completely dictated by a top-down male dominance hierarchy. One of the important things to note is that if you, as a society, as a group, if you can't defend yourself against an enemy, you're really not going to be free for very long. And one important definition of freedom is that you can defend yourself and the people you love. But the trick is that once you're well organized enough to fight an enemy successfully, and you know, of course, human history is filled with war and conflict. I cite one example, the Yamnaya, that 5,000 years ago, they were a sort of almost like the first motorcycle gang. They moved in all male groups on horse-drawn chariots with battle axes, and they plowed through Europe and invaded the Iberian Peninsula. And over a course of 100 years, they killed every single male in Neolithic Iberia, and kept the local women for themselves. The Iberians were not able to defend themselves, and they had a radical loss of freedom. But the trick is, are you militaristic enough and well-organized enough and well-led enough to defend yourselves against a group like the Yamnaya? But then also, are you able to prevent that very same militaristic structure from oppressing its own people, its own group, the way you see done in dictatorships and fascist states? Where, you know, the Saddam Hussein has this awesome military at his disposal, and then he turns it on his own people. That's something that obviously is antithetical to democracy, to freedom, and something that cannot be done here.
It's a human flaw almost, right? Because it's pretty rare that power doesn't corrupt.
Well, yeah, I mean, the brilliance of democracy is that it sort of encodes the egalitarian norms that typify hunter-gatherer society, which is our human origins, typically a group of 30 or 40, 50 people where abusive leaders can just be killed by coalition agreement. It encodes that egalitarianism where nobody, no matter how important they are, has sort of extra rights, the extra power over other people. Arbitrary, cruel power over other people. It encodes those norms in such a way that they can be applied to a country of 330 million. Do we do it perfectly? No, obviously not. There's huge, huge changes that must happen in this country to achieve more full justice for all Americans and all people. But what democratic norms do is they take that egalitarian idea and they encode it in the justice system and the political system so that it's fairly egalitarian.
And then you talk about balancing community, right? Getting us together in groups because we want to do that as a species. And then the freedom of just walking on the railroad alone. And so, but are you really free, right? Because you got a helicopter chasing you. And then can you really be free in this community? And so it really got me thinking.
Yes, we were uncontrolled in our movements and our decisions while we were on the railroad lines, right? We were outside of the sort of the surveillance state or prying neighbors or what have you. We were very good at having a kind of like tactical control where we remained out of sight at night, and we moved fairly adeptly. So like the engineers on the trains will call you in if they see you walking along the railroad lines. And so we got very good at hiding when we sensed that a train was coming and often it was sensed. Like you can hear the freight trains coming, and they come fairly slowly, about 60, 70 miles an hour. But the passenger trains would do a buck 20, and they would be on you so fast that we wouldn't have time to hide. But we got really tuned up to our environment, which is something that reminded me a little bit of combat. We got really tuned up to our environment where we would just start to sense that something huge and very fast was hurtling towards us. I don't know what it did to the air almost, but we would kind of sense it. And when we duck into the underbrush. So we got very good at sort of maintaining our low profile below the radar and hence our autonomy, much like the Apache did. But here's the thing, like your safety and your comfort come from being part of a group. Like humans die alone in nature almost immediately. And so your survival, and obviously that's a good definition of freedom, comes from the fact that you're part of a group that can support, sustain itself, and defend itself. But that means that you have to be respectful of the norms of the group. You have to do what the group needs you to do for the group to stay safe. And so you're not free. You're never free. You're never completely free and completely safe. It's impossible. So really what you have to do is choose a group to hold an allegiance to that you feel is fair, whose norms and values you respect, and that you are willing and whose rules you're willing to follow is sort of in good conscience.
So that reminds me of the neighborhood I grew up in where everybody was involved in organized crime.
Right. Right. Well, humans are humans and they organize in locally in all kinds of self ways that are meant to preserve themselves. Like I looked at a street gang called the Vice Lords in Chicago, in the Lawndale section of Chicago in the 1960s. And it was a very violent African-American community. I don't know if it still is violent. Hopefully not, but it might be. But at any rate, so the Vice Lords were formed because the young males in this area were subject to predation by other street gangs. And so they formed their own defensive group called the Vice Lords. So what did it mean to be a Vice Lord? What was the definition of being a Vice Lord? The main definition was that if you saw another Vice Lord in a fight, you ran to help no matter how bad the odds were. And if you didn't, if you ran the other way and preserved yourself, you weren't a Vice Lord. And so that agreement agreement of mutual defense is absolutely crucial to any healthy group that's going to defend itself and provide freedom to its members. I should say that if you were a Vice Lord and you didn't run and help a fellow brother who was in trouble, they didn't. The Vice Lords did not themselves punish you, right? They didn't touch you. They just put you in the back of a car and they drove you into the center of the rival group's territory, and then they just made you get out of the car. You're on your own. You want to be by? You're not going to worry about the group. The group's not going to worry about you. And that is the ancient human deal.
Reminds me of the ancient Sparta saying, right? With your shield or on it.
Yeah, so, you know, that's right.
You're not coming back home. Everybody else died. You're not coming back home alive. So you better protect your brothers. We talked about in the book, you talked about women, and it really got me thinking how powerful a woman really is. And I talked about it for the last 3 days since I read the book, right? Because, I have to imagine, and you cite some examples in battle where women have taken part. It must be really hard for the men to deal with that.
You know, first of all, individual women clearly can insert themselves in a majority male combat unit and function very, very well. And they essentially, like a civilian does, like a civilian journalist like myself, you basically adopt the norms of the group. And a combat group, those norms are obviously militaristic and male. And anyone joining it has to sort of adopt those conventions. But there are also groups of all female fighters, such as the YPG in northern Syria, who fight incredibly effectively. They're all female combat groups. They function essentially like all male combat groups. What I was writing about in Freedom was I was sort of looking for common denominators of underdog groups that were able to overthrow a greater power. And in the context of one's own society, so there's run, as I explained, there's fight. If you can't outrun them, you're going to have to outfight them. The Montenegrins defeated the Ottoman Empire in the early 1600s, despite being outnumbered 12-1, right? And they still managed to do it. But if you can't outfight them, you're going to have to outthink them. And that's where the labor movement, the Easter Rising in Ireland around 100 years ago, these societies that are you know, they're not going to run away from the dominant government, and they're not trying to overthrow it. They're trying to force the society to change in such a way that they have their own, their rights, they have justice, they have freedom. And one, so there's, you know, two main common denominators to these successful groups. First of all, is that leadership be self-sacrificing. It doesn't work if the leadership is sort of hiding behind the people that they're leading, either literally on a battlefield or figuratively. The leadership has to be willing to die for the cause. And if they're not, it's not going to, they're not going to inspire much loyalty, and the cause is pretty much guaranteed to fail. And the other thing is that, that having women be part of these initiatives is very, very important. Women have social networks that are very different from men. I mean, men gravitate towards top-down hierarchical networks that are very, very good at following orders, like run into machine gun fire until you take the enemy trench. Like that's like male social networks are very good at making that kind of thing happen. That's a very important task if you're going to fight a dominant power. But equally important are these lateral social networks that women are very good at, because they're very hard for the authorities to penetrate. A top-down male network, you take out the top guy and the network can crumble. With lateral female networks, there's no one to take out. It's a spider web, and it's very good at moving information and defeating defeating eavesdropping and spying by the government. And also, many governments, even really repressive regimes, are reluctant to use mass violence on women in the street. You put a bunch of men in the street.
Yeah, you could see why. And I thought about that. If you came upon a bunch of women in any battlefield as a man, like no matter who you are, no matter what, they gave birth to you.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a real social sanction. I mean, I think on a battlefield, shooting is happening at often 100 meters, 200 meters. Everyone's in uniform and a helmet. Like it's hard to, I think it'd be quite hard to tell gender, but you know, in uprisings in the cities of the Middle East and in the United States, the labor movement 100 years ago and any number of places, if you put a bunch of men on the street, it looks like a mob, and the police are far more willing to use deadly force to confront it. When you put women on the front line and police are given, faced with the choice of opening fire on women on the street, they are more reluctant to. And the political ramifications of doing that for the leader are way more severe. And so in the mill strikes of Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, they were protesting horrendous living conditions, ridiculously low wages, et cetera. And they didn't really start to win until they started using women. They would put women on the front line to confront National Guard soldiers with fixed bayonets, right? And the National Guard soldiers, they're all like 19-year-old kids. They didn't know what to do. And one frustrated police captain said, you know, one good cop can handle 10 men, but it takes 10 cops to handle one woman. And that was part of a dynamic that helped shift the balance of power in the street and lead to a success for the labor movement.
I love that line, and it just confirms that women have all the power.
Well, they have all of one kind of the power, and men have all of the other kind of power. When you put them together, it's a very, very daunting thing for even a repressive government to confront.
No doubt. What would you recommend to that person that's out there to experience freedom? You know, I interviewed a woman who had just climbed the Seven Summits, and she was really focused. She was thinking a lot during that whole process, and she kept thinking about how we learn helplessness in this life, especially in the first world. And you reference it a little bit in the book, but what would you recommend that person says, you know, I want to feel free, especially coming out of this year, by the way, where we felt a bit locked up in our living rooms.
We'll be right back to this interview, but first I want to talk about our sponsor, Brightside. This episode of Spartan Up is brought to you by Brightside. Dealing with anxiety or depression can be paralyzing, but you should know that you are not broken and you are not alone. This past year has taken an unprecedented toll on all of our lives. In fact, during the pandemic, 40% of Americans reported symptoms of anxiety or depression. But it's time to get back out there. Do what you need to do. And if that means help, get help. get the help you need to make changes. You can get fast, personalized, effective help from Brightside. One of their customers said, quote, "I am so relieved to have found Brightside. As someone who was having daily panic attacks and an overwhelming fear of leaving the house, I felt stuck and alone. Brightside has been a godsend and has given me the tools I need to take the steps in recovering." So listen, Spartans, if you're having a hard time, get the help you need. Brightside offers personalized, life-changing anxiety and depression care from your own home. Brightside's care is designed to follow the highest clinical standards, and they hand-select only top licensed and board-certified providers. And it's affordable, with a flat monthly fee and no hidden costs. Just go to brightside.com/Spartan and take a quick free mental health assessment. And within 48 hours, you'll be connected to an expert provider to start your personalized treatment plan. If you go to brightside.com/Spartan and take that assessment, you could get up to $100 credit on your first month's treatment. That's brightside.com/Spartan. Look, do whatever you've got to do to get back out there. All right, back to the interview.
What would you recommend that person says, you know, I want to feel free, especially coming out of this year, by the way, where we felt a bit locked up in our living rooms?
Okay, so our survival, but also our sort of like, quote, comfort comes from the fact that we are part of an affluent, industrialized, highly technological society. And we have to, most people have to work very hard every day or 5 days a week for most of the day to pay for the machines, the services, the products that keep us safe and comfortable. And so what I would say is, first of all, that the more comfort and safety you insist on, the less of your time will be available, and ultimately the less free you really will be able to be. If you have to take a shower every day, you will never be able to spend the night in the woods, right? I mean, that's just a voluntary loss of freedom. If you refuse to be hot or cold or hungry or tired or what have you, you really have to live your life in the sort of confines of a modern American lifestyle that, you know, is very free in some ways, but also creates a kind of dependency in almost everyone that is the opposite of freedom. So one of the things we were experimenting with on our trek was, if we're willing to be exhausted, we were moving 10, 20 miles a day, we were carrying 60 or 70 pounds. You know, we walked through heat waves, we walked through blizzards, you know, what have you. Like, if we were willing to suffer, would we be more free? And it's sort of in an immediate sort of animal level, absolutely. Like, it came at a high price, but we absolutely were more free. There's a more elevated conversation of like, well, what about political freedom? What about justice and all that stuff? Absolutely. That's an important conversation. But on the sheer animal level, like, are we doing what we want every day? Like, and no one's telling us what to do or where to go. Like, that's right. And it feels awesome.
I agree with that. And obviously that completely aligns, probably why I love the book so much. One of the reasons, right? Completely aligns with our message and our ethos, which is, hey, let's not forget we are animals. And as animals, we got to get out there and do some crawling and get dirty and climbing and throwing and animals. You know, I always tell people it'd be weird if you came home and your dog was sitting on the couch, as many dogs do, smoking a cigarette, watching Oprah, you know, painting her nails, let's say. That would be strange. But if you came home and the dog was running around the backyard and attacking a bird and playing in the mud, that would be normal. Well, we're the dog. We're an animal.
Yeah. I would love to read a quote from Ecclesiastes 3:18 that starts my book. And the quote from the Bible is, "As for humans, God tests them so they may know they are animals." It's exactly that animal nature that allows us to run 70 miles a day, to fight against overwhelming odds and win. And also, we're a very particular kind of animal because we have such profound cognitive abilities, allows us to play a kind of chess game against the authorities and win.
Tell me about this whole couch thing, this drive towards comfort, complacency. When did that start?
Well, you know, as animals, all of our tendencies and tastes are adaptive and reflect something about our evolutionary past. So seeking comfort and ease certainly is a good thing to do, because there probably wasn't much of it in our evolutionary past. We have mechanized society such that we can be comfortable virtually all the time. And so there's a downside to that. Like there's a downside to being able to eat as much sugar as we want. We have a taste for sugar because it's in small quantities, it's good for us in fruit. But now we gorge on sugar, it's not good for us. So how do we think about that? Around 10,000 years ago, the first agricultural communities sprang up. So instead of herding or hunting and gathering, they plowed, they planted, and they harvested, and they were able to accumulate enormous amounts of food, essentially of wealth, and establish, you know, city-states of tens of thousands of people with massive armies, very regulated, very controlled, not very free, but free of hardship in a lot of ways. Then mobile societies around them 10,000 years ago lived much poorer lives materially, much harder lives in a sense because they were constantly on the move, but they were egalitarian and they had this amazing arrogance about their own sort of value vis-a-vis their wealthy neighbors in the valleys. And that's something you see quite a lot in the human story is that this mobile societies, even if they're poorer, they feel superior to the couch bound sedentary people that have more. And so there was a tribe in northern Iran called the Yarmouk, and they had a saying about their farmer neighbors. It was, "I do not have a mill with willow trees." In other words, I'm not a farmer. "I do not have a mill with willow trees. I have a horse and quirt." A quirt is a whip. "I have a horse and quirt. I will kill you and go." And so there you see the arrogance of mobile societies. And so, you know, what I would say is that we have a sedentary society. We romanticize mobility and even motorcycle gangs. You know, like we think we see them in this. We're like, oh, yeah, those guys, like they got something we don't have. Right. And in an ancient human sense, you're kind of right.
Gotta get everybody out just to a Spartan race. They don't have to get a motorcycle or join a gang. What you found yourself succumbing to wanting some comfort and wanting to give up during this 400-mile train track, right? How'd you get through that?
Yeah, I mean, I was an athlete since from age 15 on. I was a really competitive distance runner in high school and college. I ran a pretty good mile time, pretty good marathon. I know how to hurt, right? I know how to make my body perform. I know how to hurt. I know how to push through like these mental barriers. And the most of the difficulty in endurance sports is mental. I mean, the weak link is your mind, right? Because at any moment you can decide, the hell with it. I'm just going to sit down. So every single, in a sense, you're at risk of stopping at every single step in a marathon or in a 400-mile railroad line track or whatever it may be. And so you need these tricks to defy your mind. And one thing that can happen is that you get into what I call cadence, where you get into such a rhythm, particularly with other people, that it almost feels like it's easier to walk than not walk, where stopping looks like the tedious, the tiresome thing to do. And you're just rolling along. And that is a kind of blessed state that can last for, you know, hours. You could cover 20 miles like that. It doesn't really feel like anything. But the other thing you can do is to sort of bully your brain. And I would get into this thing where I'd be like, when I would start to feel tired and I knew I wasn't exhausted, but my mind was failing. I was like, all right, you're going to feel tired. What do you think of this? And I would pick up the pace, right? I would go faster. I'm like, you complain to me, I'm just going to punish you more. Or I'd put some more weight in my pack. And there was something about like making it harder that changed the dynamic with your brain and with my brain and allowed me to sort of maintain control over the conversation I was having with myself.
I've been there. I get it completely. And one of our best athletes ever, a guy named Hobie Call, he said, when you're tired and you're running, why do you have to slow down? Why not speed up? Well, you're awesome. I'm super, super pumped that you were willing to come on. Everybody's got to go buy the book. And I might read it three or four more times. Who knows?
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Little man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Spartan Up Podcast. Spartan Up is your partner in resilience for mind, body, and spirit. We're here 3 days every week Tuesdays, you can find Joe DeSena, founder and CEO of Spartan, interviewing biohackers, business leaders, authors, and athletes. Thursdays and Saturdays, catch episodes from our DECA, Endurance, Trail, Combat, and La Ruta series. Do you know someone who needs a little nudge? Maybe they could use some motivation, tactics, to be stronger, healthier, happier, more successful. Tell them about our show. And if you're watching on YouTube, leave us a comment. We want to know who's watching and who's listening. Thanks. See you next time. This episode of Spartan Up is brought to you by Brightside. Dealing with anxiety or depression can be paralyzing, but you should know you are not broken and you're not alone. And when you want help, Brightside is there for you. Take a free mental health assessment and get up to $100 credit on your first month of treatment at brightside.com/Spartan. That's brightside.com/Spartan.